Hey, good morning, Sam. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great. We've got a really exciting show lined up today with four great guests. We have Roger Downs here in the studio, and coming up soon on the phone, we have Wes Gillingham, Sandra Steingraber, and Dr. David Carpenter. All of that coming up momentarily.
Sounds great, Sam. This is Tell It Like It Is, every Thursday at 10 a.m.
Welcome back to Tell It Like It Is. We're really excited about our show today on hydrofracking in New York State. And we have some great guests. We're really honored to have here in the studio with us today Roger Downs, who is the legislative director for the Sierra Club Atlantic chapter. How's it going, Roger?
It's good. The honor's all mine, Sam. It's great to be here.
All right. And on the phone, let's make sure he's there. We have Wes Gillingham. Wes, are you there?
Oh, let's try this one.
Hey, Wes, are you there?
I am here.
All right. All right. So on the phone, we have with us today Wes Gillingham, Program Director for Catskill Mountain Keeper. Catskill Mountain Keeper is a nonprofit environmental advocacy organization dedicated to creating a flourishing, sustainable economy in the Catskills and preserving and protecting the area's long-term health and natural resources. And so, Wes and Roger, let's just jump right into it here. Wes, I know a lot of people right now are under the impression, having heard that New York is in a moratorium from fracking, that there is no harmful drilling currently going on. And I was wondering if you could speak about the moratorium and what your goals are for legislation on fracking.
Well, one of the issues is the, you know, just throwing the word moratorium around. In effect, what we have is industry is holding back and not going forward with horizontal drilling and hydrofracking in the low permeability shale because New York State is going through a supplemental generic impact statement process. But they actually could drill by their own choice if they did an individual environmental impact statement on each well site, which they're not wanting to do. But so technically there isn't really a moratorium. Industry is making that choice not to drill. But the other thing that's happening is hydrofracking is happening in vertical wells in the Marcellus and in other formations. So it's the same issues with the chemicals and a lot of the potential dangers. It's just with a lot less volume of chemicals and water being used. But some of those same issues are happening.
Right.
In different parts of the state. And people are having issues with their well water and issues with truck traffic and issues with potential spills. So we're kind of in a holding pattern now for the complete industrialization of the landscape, which most of us are worried about from the horizontal drilling.
Right. So what would be your, at this point, what are you working toward in terms of the legislation on fracking in New York?
Well, actually, one of the things that Mountain Keeper is focusing on, besides specific legislation, is really getting health impact hearings going on mm-hmm. on the state level. Having the Assembly, getting the ENCON, the Environmental Conservation Committee, and getting the chair of the health committee to come and do hearings and get experts from other parts of the country to talk about the issues that those places are dealing with this gas drilling development. And that's really important because, as we saw in the supplemental process, that was pretty much left out. Even the section on air was pretty lacking. And, you know, air quality is something that we have a lot of science to show, you know, when air quality is degraded, what the impact is to, you know, to children and elderly. There's a lot of science out there. So it's not like inventing this stuff, but we just need to take a closer look at what the impacts are to air quality. You know, the famous example is Boulder, Wyoming, which is a really small town of a few hundred, and they reached pollution levels near Los Angeles because of the gas drilling development in that region.
Wes, can you just explain how that is connected? This is Christina. How hydrofracking actually affects air quality?
Well, there's a number of ways. I mean, you've got the extreme volumes of truck traffic, both, you know, the workers coming and going, then all the equipment coming in, the generators that are running the equipment on site. Then you have leakage from the gathering lines and the pipelines. And one of the major impacts to air quality is the compressor stations, where they are taking the gas and getting it to the correct pressure to then go into a main transmission line and carry the gas to a place. So there's quite a bit of emissions that come out of these compressor stations. And that's the, you know, a lot of people who have been following this issue are familiar with Mayor Calvin Tillman and Dish, Texas, where the town spent a substantial part of their town budget to do their own air quality testing because they weren't getting satisfactory results from the state, and they found, you know, extreme levels of benzene and a whole host of toxins and carcinogens in their air. And that was because Dish, Texas, not only has development around the drilling development, but the big thing they have is it's a cross-section of a number of pipelines and the compressor stations there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people just across the town were complaining of headaches, and you know, there was a direct impact or a direct relationship between complaints about air quality and when certain things were happening with the compressor stations.
Hey, Wes, this is Roger from Sierra Club. I just wanted to get back to the SGEIS. We know it's going to be due out in July. You and I both read the original document, and part of the argument that the DEC has used is that they've said they won't do health impact studies because they have not identified any clear exposure pathways, how the public will actually be receiving these fracking chemicals or you know, other toxins, so that they won't study that. Is that something that you know, we think we can get in the next draft?
Well, I think that's why it's important that we have these health impact hearings, is to really highlight those pathways. You know, just, again, going back to some of the things we already know, and you're going to have Sandra on in a moment to talk about that, but you know, there's things, impacts of diesel that we know about, and you know, exposure to diesel in drinking water or exposure to diesel emissions in the air, and there's plenty of science out there on that. So what we need to do is have these hearings and look at where those exposure levels have gone up in places where development is happening, and then make those correlations with the known science, and then, if need be, curtail the level of development. I mean, this is one of those situations where how this development goes forward will have, you know, long-term effects, generational effects on our community, and we can't go forward with this stuff without really understanding it.
I've always found it funny, too, that the DEC requires that all their inspectors have personal air quality monitors on their bodies when they do well inspections for hydrogen sulfide emissions and other things to protect their workers, and yet somehow they can't identify exposure pathways. So
Right.
Yeah.
Guys, can we just, for people who don't know, the Department of Environmental Conservation, DEC, and you mentioned SGIS.
So this is the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. This is a supplement to the generic environmental impact statement that they did in 1992. When one wants to drill a well, they don't have to go through an extensive EIS process because the department claims they did it for everyone in 1992. So this is just to supplement the work that was done back then.
Wow.
So yeah, basically the supplement is there because the combination of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing and the mixture of chemicals they're using was not covered in the old document at all. It's a new combination of technologies, and the way that the development plays out is completely different. In the original GEIS, it says, due to the nature of gas drilling, there's no cumulative impact. Well, obviously that's an outdated piece of information. It probably wasn't even true then. So. And, you know, and what we've got to do is look at those impacts. And again, looking at air quality, the way those permits go forward, the way it's being proposed now, we'll see how it comes out in the next draft. They're just looking at the impacts of an individual well pad and the trucks that might be on site versus aggregating what even an individual company is doing across the region. So you've got a company with, a series of equipment in, multiple, going at multiple well pads, and they're not putting two and two together and looking at regional air quality, and that's a huge mistake. And that same thing is happening, with some of the impacts with water. That was one of the things that played out in Pennsylvania was the combination of taking the fracking fluid to all the public waste treatment facilities, and then going into the rivers and streams, it was permitted legally at every individual treatment facility, but they didn't, again, put two and two together and realize the impact of every single treatment facility taking this stuff and putting it into the, basin-wide, and it had major impacts on the water systems there.
Hmm.
I just want to ask, because we're running out of time, it's unbelievable, but what can people do now to, first of all, inform themselves and to act on these issues?
Well, there's multiple organizations out there working working on this issue. So there's plenty of websites to find. You can go to CatskillMountainKeeper.org. There's the Clean Water, Not Dirty Drilling. .org website, there's the Sierra Club website, and as you go to one, there's links to other ones. So the best thing would be to really find a local group that is working on this issue and get involved on it in any way you can. Right now there's a series of bills going through. One of the most important things to show support with your legislators, so we have a situation in New York where this stuff is not classified as toxic or hazardous chemicals. Even if it qualifies, they're exempt from that. It gets treated as industrial waste, and that changes how this stuff is treated, and that really needs to change.
I find that almost unbelievable.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that bill later.
Yeah.
It's an important bill.
Do we know exactly what chemicals are being used for hydrofracking, or is it the same proprietary knowledge where the public can't find out what those chemicals are as the same chemicals that were used in the BP oil debacle, the dispersants? Is that the same situation?
Yes. Some of the chemicals are known. I've done research with data sheets from haulers and things like that, so we know some of the chemicals. What is proprietary and holding close to their chest is what they're using in any given area, because it changes. And so out of the list of 300 something chemicals, they may be only using 10 or 15 on a particular given operation, but you don't know which 10 or 15 that is. And some of the companies keep saying they're going to disclose this stuff, but we're not seeing it across in the industry. And then we just recently had hearings that show that they were using diesel fuel in many states as part of the process, and that they said they weren't. You know, so there was a number of years going that basically industry was lying to the public and the regulators and the agencies.
Yeah, they had an agreement. They promised they wouldn't use diesel fuel. It wasn't mandated in regs, but they said they would discontinue the practice, and they just kept doing it.
You know, we're going to continue this conversation with our next guest, Sandra. But, Wes, thank you so much for speaking to us this morning. We really appreciate it.
And, again, it's Wes Gillingham.
Wes is with Catskill Mountain Keeper, catskillmountainkeeper.org.
Thank you, Wes.
No, thank you. Thank you for covering this issue.
Okay.
We're going to go to a little music right now, and we're going to get Sandra Steingraber on the line.
Thank you. like to make a call, please hang on.
Hi, you're listening to Tell It Like It Is on WGXC 90.7 FM. We're having some technical difficulties at the moment getting our next guest on, but we're here in the studio with Roger Downs from the Sierra Club, and we're talking about hydrofracking in New York State today. Roger, did you have any thoughts to add to any of Wes's comments?
Well, there's a tremendous amount that is going on in Albany, and you know, there is some question as to what we can get past the Senate, but right now there's more than two dozen bills of substance dealing with hydrofracking, and you know, we're trying to see what we can get done, and I can go through a few of them of importance, but I wanted to highlight two things that are happening on Monday in Albany. One, there's a big rally for a ban of hydrofracking, and that's in support of the Avella-Colton bill. The Senate number is 4220. 4220 or fight is the slogan that they use. But this would ban all hydrofracking in New York. And the rally will be outside of the Capitol in West Capitol Park at 10 o'clock. It also happens to be Legislative Earth Day because the legislature rewarded themselves with an on-time budget by taking an extra week off. They weren't around for Earth Day.
Oh.
So we're all going to be around to remind them that they have an obligation to the environment. And there's five bills that are going to be part of that day. Registration is through the NYPERG website. You know, if you want to lobby, there will be lobbying in the afternoon, and in the morning there will be a morning program with various guest politicians talking about various bills. And one of the bills on the agenda will be a very important hydrofracking bill that I can talk about later. Shall I talk about it now?
That's a lot of activities all happening in front of the Capitol on Monday.
Right, and then the Legislative Earth Day is happening inside the Legislative Office Building, inside the Capitol.
Oh,
so we have
okay.
events going on outside the Capitol, inside the Capitol, you know, it'll be a good day.
Wow. Well, we can talk more about that in a minute. I think we hopefully now have Dr. Sandra Steingraber on the line with us.
Hello.
A loud dial tone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, and we're trying to fix the dial tone. Sorry, Sandra. Sorry, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, I think we got that. Sorry about that. We're a brand new station with a lot of new technology, and all of our apologies there to you and our listeners, but we're so happy to have you on the line now. We're
happy to be here.
We're speaking to let our listeners know with Dr. Sandra Steingraber, ecologist, author, and cancer survivor, who is an internationally recognized authority on the environment links to cancer and human health, and also has a brand new book out called Raising Elijah, and I haven't read that yet, Sandra, but I'm really looking forward to reading that. And let's just jump into the conversation here.
Okay.
So, Sandra, this is Christina, and the reason why, and also, Sandra, if you can speak directly into the phone, that's great. The reason, one of the reasons why we got you on the air is because we also are promoting your film about you, Living Downstream, which is a feature documentary about your book titled Living Downstream, which will be at the Rosendale Theater in Rosendale, New York, this Sunday, May 1st at 2 o'clock. There's a suggested donation for that, and people can call here at the station. We'll have links to that, so I highly recommend that. But I found out about you. Sam actually had a clip of you at the rally in Albany against fracking, and the reason why I know about you is from a cancer support group's mailing, and what's important is that you're making a direct connection as a biologist between toxins in the environment and cancer.
That has been the focus of my research for the past two decades, and you're right to suggest that my interest in that topic came as a result of my own cancer diagnosis. So I was 20 years old when I was diagnosed with bladder cancer. I was in between my sophomore and junior years in college. I had planned at that time to go on to medical school. I was kind of a high-achieving biology major that ran around with a bunch of other pre-med students. But that experience, especially my physician's own questions about my possible environmental exposures, led me to the medical library, and I realized not only did the kind of cancer I have lots of environmental connections with it, associated with it. Bladder cancer is considered a kind of quintessential environmental cancer. Mm-hmm. But I also learned that a lot of chemicals linked to bladder cancer, we have absolute proof for their ability to cause this disease, and yet nothing in our regulatory system prevents them from continuing to be used. So years later, with the help of, you know, a PhD in biology and a Harvard postdoctoral fellowship, I went back to my hometown and discovered chemicals in the drinking water wells that are, in fact, linked to dry bladder cancer, namely the presence of dry cleaning fluid. So now, you know, many years later, here I am living in upstate New York, and we are facing an extreme form of energy extraction, namely hydrofracking, which relies on some of the same chemicals that I know very well, because I have an intimate relationship with them and their ability to cause certain kinds of cancer, both as an individual patient, but also as a researcher who's investigating them. And so my interest is in doing some science for the people and explaining what my concerns about the use of highly toxic chemicals in this form of research resource extraction called hydrofracking.
You also talk about the effects of these chemicals on children and during their developmental stages. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, so my new book, Raising Elijah, which was just launched last week, takes a look at a whole variety of environmental threats to child development, and is named after my own 9-year-old son, Elijah, who is a child with an asthma history and with some life-threatening allergies that require us to carry around an EpiPen and things like that. And so, again, based on my own autobiography as a mother of a child who's got a problem that is related to an environmental exposure, namely air pollutants, not that that's what caused his problems, but air pollution is definitely related to the severity of asthma symptoms and asthma attacks and so forth. So that prompted me to write a book in which I take a look at fetal toxicology and the pathways of child development and the ways in which those can be sabotaged by low-level exposure to certain chemical pollutants. And these include outcomes not only asthma, but also preterm birth is linked to air pollution exposure. And PCBs, which is a big topic that the film Living Downstream raises, and of course is of interest to those who live up and down the Hudson River Valley. PCBs are known to shorten human pregnancies, and preterm births are leading cause of disability in the United States, and adds billions of dollars to our health care every year because it requires lifelong, a child born very premature requires lifelong medical intervention and special education and all kinds of other social services. So I take a look at this as a human rights issue. These chemicals actually sabotage human pregnancies. I think there's a message here for the right to life community as well as the pro-choice community. I would say I'm on the pro-choice side of that great divide, but nevertheless, I think whether you look at chemicals that interfere with pregnancy from the point of view of women's reproductive rights, as I do, or whether fetal sanctity and the idea of fetal rights is your issue, I think there's a place here in both the film Living Downstream and my new book where Right to Life and pro-choice groups could find some common ground, namely around the idea that any chemical that has the power to extinguish human pregnancy or to interfere with the development of a child has no place in our economy. And sadly, a lot of those chemicals are used in fracking. Therefore, that makes a very powerful human rights argument for the ban on fracking that many of us are hoping will be the outcome of the current debate here in upstate New York. And of course, these are also very expensive problems. Asthma adds $18 billion a year to healthcare costs. And so forth. And so there's also a sort of fiscal conservative argument, I think, to not embracing a form of energy extraction that is going to add all kinds of costs to special education and medical care dollars. Those are two parts of our budget here in New York we already have slashed.
I have a question for you, and maybe even Roger can get on this. Roger Downs from the Sierra Club. There's a direct connection between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. People can have sued, but it took a lot of legal battles in order for that to occur, for that to be established. How do we, right now, it sounds like we can't even identify the chemicals that are being used in hydrofracking, and can we make a direct correlation, a legal correlation, where somebody can sue? Because, you know, if you get exposed to this and then 10 years later, maybe you develop a cancer. How does that work? Can you guys address that, please?
Well, I can give it a try. I mean, you're right. The fracking enjoys many exemptions from our federal legislative statutes, and including the Safe Drinking Water Act, and therefore does not need to reveal the actual identity of the chemicals that it pumps into the ground. But my hope is that we'll never get to the point where we have to conduct studies as we have in the Hudson River where we try to understand who's been exposed and who suffers from what, disastrous outcomes. That kind of epidemiology can only be done after the damage is done. And I'm seeking a far more precautionary approach. Mm-hmm. That being said, it is true for those of us in the research community, the case that we can make is made more difficult by the secrecy enjoyed by the industry. Nevertheless, you know, no matter what chemicals they're using, pumping into the ground, to get the gas out of the ground requires tremendous amounts of pressure, right? 10,000 pounds per square inch. Therefore, many compressors and diesel trucks, and so we know for a fact that our air will be filled with diesel exhaust, and air quality will be degraded. That's a fact. That's not something that's secret. That's something that's just known to happen in every gas patch. Ozone levels go way up and so forth. Ozone in specific is related to stunted lung development in children. So this is a prediction that we can easily make that doesn't require, you know, forcing the industry to reveal anything else. We know that children's respiratory health will be damaged when we fill our rural roads up with 18-wheeler tanker trucks hauling hazmat and compressor and condenser stations, all of which are running on diesel, and wellheads, which will certainly release volatile organics, which will combine with the diesel to create smog from all of these different wells. We don't need to change any laws to make that case. We know that will happen.
Yeah, that's, you're touching also, Sandra, on the fact that this isn't really a left or a right political issue. As you said, it's a human rights issue that this is really, all of our, the land and water that belongs to all of us. And, it, you know, we don't deserve to have our land and water destroyed by these corporations.
Well, that's right, and it's, you know, it's an economic issue too. And the promise of the number of jobs that might be provided, you know, we have a metric for that, and that is very attractive to communities. We don't have a metric for saying, well, you know, so there's a certain number of jobs and a certain number of economic development that we can provide some numbers for. But we don't have a number for the number of children who will now have asthma, the number of lost pregnancies, the number of babies born prematurely. Ultrafine particles from diesel exhaust are also related to diabetes, stroke, mm-hmm. cardiac problems, heart attack, bladder cancer. So these will almost certainly go up as well, and add rocks to the pocket of our healthcare costs. But we don't really have hard numbers on those, right? And so we're trying to, they're invisible to us, those costs. But cancer and preterm birth are two of the most expensive things that can happen to you, both as an individual and in terms of, you know, what health insurance has to pay for. So without a real understanding of the health costs, we can kind of blindly walk our way into a very toxic form of energy extraction that will actually economically harm our communities more than they'll benefit. And that's the story of, for example, trash incinerators. The one that came online in 1989 in Detroit promised 75 jobs, and it's still going. It's now considered a dinosaur, and it has damaged the air of the community. There's some of the highest asthma rates in Detroit. Asthma is the number one cause of school absenteeism among children. It's sabotaged recycling efforts, and it's cost the community so much money, but there's no really easy way to shut it down once it's online. It may have killed more people than it provided jobs for. And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves with fracking before we wander into this, you know.
Yeah.
Are we, you know.
Now's the moment.
You provide some jobs, but you kill a certain number of kids. Is that what we want for our future?
Exactly.
Mm. Well, Sandra, we're unfortunately, I'm sorry about the technical difficulties earlier, but we're running out of time. But we do want to plug again your book. Or first of all, the film Living Downstream, which is a film that was actually produced by the People's Picture Company of Toronto, and it will be playing for a suggested donation at the Rosendale Theatre this Sunday from May 1st from 2 to 5. And there is a suggested donation, and we can give out more information about how to find out.
And just to say, put in a sort of another plug, which is that the discussion will be led by Dr. David Carpenter, who's probably the world's expert on PCBs. And there's such an important message in Living Downstream for the anti-fracking movement, although it's more implicit, mm-hmm. which is that it's clear that PCBs found their way through naturally occurring fissures in the bedrock, right, mm-hmm. to get into the Hudson River. So the story of PCBs as told in Living Downstream and as Dr. Carpenter, I wish I could be in the audience just to hear what he's going to say. He's brilliant, and he's so good. He's so lyrical in his explanations.
He's joining us in a couple of minutes.
Oh, good. Perfect. Yes. Yeah. He's my hero. So I'm just thrilled he's leading the discussion. So, you know, I think the message of what happened to the Hudson and the way it got contaminated, the story of the shale and the way the contaminants actually traveled through shales in a way not thought possible is a lesson we need to take forward and make public about, you know, what if this happened with fracking fluid, not just PCBs.
Okay.
And Raising Elijah, I hope, is also useful. My new book, it's, I think, the first book that deals with the health impacts of fracking. There's a whole chapter on that topic. The science that exists to us is sort of a thin body of knowledge, but I try to provide and bring some plain spoken English to that and explain to people what we do know about the health risks so far.
And that was put out by DeCapo Press?
DeCapo Press, and the book is Raising Elijah. Uh-huh.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it and all the work that you're doing.
Yeah, well, thanks for what you guys are doing.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. So, Roger, let's give you a couple of minutes here. But thank you so much for coming in the studio and
sure.
to comment on some of what's been said so far.
Well, you know, I think there's so much to say on this issue. You know, one of the exposure pathways that, you know, I work as a lobbyist in Albany, and, you know, I have to sort of sort through these bills. You know, one thing that Wes mentioned, and I just want to elaborate a little bit on, is that, you know, the industry enjoys so many exemptions. And when we're talking about toxins, one thing that's is really remarkable is that a lot of these fracking chemicals, they arrive on site in hazmat trucks. You know, there's manifests, it's regarded as hazardous material in these containers before it's diluted and pumped down into the ground. And they're allowed to pump it into the ground as, you know, a pressurized system mixed with water and sand. When it comes back out, federal and state legal exemptions suddenly clear it of its hazardous exemption. And for the majority of the time, these fluids are considered hazardous. And yet, when they're somehow washed by the legislature, so to speak, we want to close that hazardous waste loophole. So there's an important bill that was introduced a few weeks ago. It is the Assembly bill. It's a Bob Sweeney bill, 7013. Tony Avella has it in the Senate, 4616. But we'd like to get a lot of public pressure on this because right now drilling is going on in New York. It's kind of a misnomer. But it's vertical drilling, and it is, in smaller volumes. But still,
we have a lot of frack waste out there, and it's important for the public to know where this frack waste is going, and that it's treated properly until the DEC can sort out the rest through this ongoing process.
Right. There's so much that needs to be done before we, if this is going to happen. I mean. For instance, you know, in Greene County, there is a rail line going right through Catskill, Athens, Saugerties, mm-hmm. which could be used to transport we don't know what. And that could end up being some play a role in the transportation of fracking waste, which is not even regulated.
Right. And, you know, I think when we're talking about Columbia and Greene counties, I mean, we have to look at what could potentially happen here. I mean, right now the hot spots are Broome County, along the southern tier, southern Catskills, where there's pipeline infrastructure. But we also have a pipeline. And while we may not have, the choice geology, we are still in Utica Shale. And that once you get beyond west of 32, beyond Greenville, I think that there are some viable gas deposits there. And they haven't been targeted yet. But with that pipeline infrastructure, with the rail infrastructure, this may be something we may be seeing in 15, 20 years.
The Iroquois pipeline?
The Iroquois pipeline, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sorry to interrupt, guys, but I think we have Dr. David Carpenter on the line.
Oh, okay.
So let's see.
It's a jam-packed show today.
Can you hear us, Dr. Carpenter? Okay, let's try this one.
Hello?
Okay. Dr. Carpenter, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. We're a fairly new station, and our phone lines are new, so thank you so much, first of all, for joining us this morning. We had some difficulty getting Dr. Sandra Steingraber on the line, so we're running a little bit late, but she did refer to you as her hero. and you will be speaking, again, another plug for Living Downstream, which is a feature documentary based on the book by Dr. Sandra Steingraber, Ph.D., who and Dr. Carpenter will be speaking there. It will be at the Rosendale Theater May 1st at 2 p.m. And there's a suggested donation for that. And I can give out more information after the show. But I just want to tell people that Dr. David O. Carpenter is a public health physician whose current position is director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University of Albany, as well as professor of environmental health sciences within the School of Public Health. So thank you so much for joining us, and I'll just start by asking you about the impact of hydrofracking on public health.
Well, the big concern is that we really don't know how serious the impact will be. We have a fair bit of information coming from what's been happening in Pennsylvania, and everything we know is of great worry. There has been contamination of groundwater, for rural residents that derive their water from groundwater. And that's not surprising because the process of hydrofracking involves injection of huge amounts of water containing a large number of chemicals, and unfortunately the nature of all of the chemicals that are used has not been totally released. We're getting a little bit of information about some of those chemicals. But when you inject chemicals in a water solution in the ground, of course it's going to go in the groundwater. And if one happens to derive your drinking water from a well, and if the groundwater stream that your well derives from is upstream from the fracking chemicals, why, of course, it's going to contaminate your water supply. The other problem that has appeared, you know, the whole purpose of hydrofracking is to release natural gas that's trapped in the rock formation, and the explosion problem is not insignificant. Turn on their faucet and light a match and find the whole thing either explodes or lights up. Obviously, your health hazard. So I think that the issue is that the full extent of the risks from hydrofracking are not really known. We know some of the specific things that have happened in states that have allowed fracking. But the problem is, of course, there is an economic benefit to deriving income from the state from the source of all that natural gas. And if it could be done safely, it would be of benefit to the state. Everything I know about it at the present time suggests that it is not being done safely with adequate protection of our groundwater supplies and protection of the health of the people that are dependent on groundwater just for normal household needs.
Right. Dr. Carpenter, there was also the issue of air quality that both Dr. Steingraber and Wes Gillingham from Riverkeeper mentioned, just the amount of diesel that's produced in the transport and digging and drilling for it. Can you address that also, please?
Well, yes. I've been very involved in the effects of air pollution. And, of course, there's nothing unique about the air pollution coming from the diesel that would be released in these operations as compared to what is released from normal highway traffic and so forth. But we're actually just completing a manuscript right now where we've looked at rates of hospitalization for asthma and respiratory infections and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in people that happen to live near coal-fired, gas-fired, and liquid gas power plants. And we find that just living near those sites, those are stationary sources of air pollution. And air pollution is both particles, particulate air pollution, it's sulfur dioxide, it's nitrogen oxides, and those on sunny days create ozone, create smog. And all of those factors increase the risk of respiratory disease and secondarily the risk of heart disease. Now, you know, there are certainly pollution control devices that can be put on diesel equipment anywhere. I think there are not so many air pollution concerns from the fracking process itself, but it obviously does involve heavy equipment, a lot of which uses diesel fuel, and those are going to increase local air pollution.
Dr. Carpenter, this is Roger Downs from the Sierra Club. Thank you for coming on. I had a question about compressor stations. I mean, certainly we have
this fracking process, there are air quality impacts that are temporary with the drilling of each well, but the compressor stations remain for 30 years or more in this pipeline complex, and there's leakage from pipelines. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, certainly this has been an issue in the West, and as we perhaps, if this happens in New York, would increase our pipeline compressor station infrastructure, what kind of impact that will have on public health?
Well, I think we all remember the village outside of San Francisco that basically blew up from a natural gas pipeline that ruptured. The reality is we have these pipelines all across New York State right now, and we haven't had major episodes in recent years at least, but there's always this problem that infrastructure like underground pipelines ages and does leak and causes certain risk of rupture and blow-ups. Certainly the more pipelines you have, the greater that risk is. The newer ones that are installed are probably going to be a lot safer than older ones that have been in place for a long period of time. I don't see the pipeline issue as being as serious as the general issue of the lack of maintenance of underground infrastructure. I would probably be more concerned about some of the existing lines that have been there for years that haven't been maintained well. But there certainly is the possibility that when you have these compressor stations, you're going to have new pipelines that go from them. And all of those have a certain risk of failure at some time.
Dr. Carpenter, do you work directly with the DEC or are there agencies? I'm trying to get a picture of our public health and how that connects up to regulatory agencies in New York State.
No, I don't work directly with the DEC. I was employed by the Department of Health for many years, and then in 1998 moved to the University of Albany. I must say that I find that there are some major restrictions of working for government because agencies, no matter what agency or under what administration, there is a great tendency to try to control what employees speak about, and it's an effort to have a uniform message that often comes down from the top and many times may not be the most informed message. But at the same time, there's some very good people that work at DC and very good people that work at DOH, but I think there is a very important role for people from the academic community, from the Sierra Club, from the other non-government organizations to speak up and hold the feet to the fire of the people that work for government.
Especially as the DEC is, you know, so many cutbacks happening and we're dealing with an issue that, if anything, needs more people working on it and more regulation. All the more reason that we need people like Roger here in the studio with us in the Sierra Club working on this as well.
Well, I totally agree with that. And, you know, in all the years that I worked for the Department of Health, there were many occasions when people would be absolutely incensed about an issue but be prohibited from speaking out because a governor sets a policy or a commissioner sets a policy. No one that works for those agencies is allowed to publicly question that policy. Now, in the first place, I don't think that's necessarily the best strategy. We've sort of seen in, at least in the previous presidential administration, many examples of their not being allowed to be vigorous debate. Of the people that had a contrary point of view were basically not even allowed to get access to the president to express that. Mm-hmm. Well, that happens at a level of agencies in state and local government as well. And having someone to question decisions is very, very important. Now, the reality is that DEC is really being cut off at its knees mm-hmm. in terms of resources. And while I have the highest regard for most of the people I know there, there are great limits in what they can do, both in terms of what they can, what they'll have time for, and secondly, in terms of what they're allowed to do. Mm-hmm. And it's a particular problem when you have an issue like fracking, where the economic return to the state in terms of natural gas is very, very attractive to a lot of people that either know less or more seriously care less about the environment. And nobody should believe that DEC has total control over this situation.
Right.
They're a state agency. They report to the governor. And the governor and the governor's office is really the place where decisions are going to be made.
Well,
technical support is going to come from DEC, but to a degree they're going to be told what their ruling can be.
And that's why people need to really be paying attention to this issue and getting involved as much as they can.
In wrapping up, we only have pretty much 2 minutes, so I just wanted to ask, from your role as a scientist, as an environmental scientist, as where are you directing your studies right now? Because I think it's important that the science is done, but I think it's important that the science gets done before the fact, and not after the fact. So, what are you advising? What are you advising people to do now? Where do we stand with this?
Well, it's very difficult to do the science before the project, at least in my kind of science, because what I try to study is human disease in relation to various environmental exposures. And the problem here is, number one, we don't even know the chemicals, so it's very hard to determine what the health effects of those chemicals are if they get in someone's drinking water. We don't really know the magnitude of the problem of the explosions and the fires from the kitchen sink. Certainly we know that those pose health hazards if they do occur. But the way I would approach research is to look at a situation and then study the health of the people around that site. And unfortunately that can only be done after the site's operational.
Well, Dr. Carpenter, I really want to thank you for joining us this morning, and we look forward to hearing from you or at the Living Downstream
screening,
which will be happening May 1st at 2 p.m. at the Rosendale Theater, and folks can call in to the WGXC station to get more information or check it out on our website. Thank you so much, Dr. Carpenter.
Well, thank you for dealing with such an important subject.
Appreciate it.
Thanks. And we just want to also mention, Roger, could you just mention again what's happening on Monday?
So on Monday, 10 a.m., the rally will start for a ban of hydrofracking in New York. That will be outside the state capitol in Albany. And at the same time, it's Earth Day Lobby Day inside the Capitol in Hearing Room C of the Legislative Office Building. If you want to lobby in the afternoon, you have to register at the NYPIRG website. But it should be a good day in Albany to fight back.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming into the studio today, Roger. It's great
pleasure.
To see you. And there you have it. That was another edition of Tell It Like It Is, and we'll see you next week, everybody.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Christina.
Thank you, Sam. Stay tuned for Al Jazeera.
Hello, I'm Wes Gillingham, the program director for Catskill Mountain Keeper, and you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Acre, New York. And it's time to wake up and pay attention to gas drilling. It's happening in New York, and we need to change the regulations.
We want to know what you think. WGXC invites listeners to share their ideas, input, feedback, praise, and critiques. Email feedback at wgxc.org or drop a note at our Hudson studio at 704 Columbia Street, second floor.
This is Al Jazeera English, broadcast exclusively on the Pacifica Radio Network.
This is Al Jazeera.
Welcome to the News Hour on Al Jazeera. I'm Kamal Santamaria. Live from our Doha and Washington news centers, these are your top stories. Fatah and Hamas agree to reconcile their differences, but Israel warns of dire consequences for peace in the region.
The Palestinian Authority must choose either peace with Israel or peace with Hamas. Peace with both of them is not possible.
The political resignations in Syria continue as more tanks roll in to crush the anti-government protests. And education on hold in Benghazi. Children in the Libyan town haven't seen the inside of a classroom for weeks.
Hello, I'm Daljit Dhaliwal in Washington with news from the Americas, including...
We do not have time for this kind of silliness. We got better stuff to do.
President Barack Obama offers more proof he was born in the United States of America.